Australia has growing concerns about Pacific nations becoming indebted to China, but Senator Cormann denied the loan was designed to prevent China from holding PNG's debt.
Oh, it's completely unrelated. I mean, we have a long-standing relationship with Papua New Guinea. It's in our national interest for Papua New Guinea to have a stable fiscal system and fiscal outlook.
The loan is unusual because for the last two decades, Australia has assiduously avoided giving PNG direct budget support because of concerns about corruption and economic mismanagement.
That's Matthias Cormann, former Finance Minister of Australia and now the head of the Organisation for Economic Development. He was speaking in late 2019, just after the Australian government gave a $400 million loan to Papua New Guinea, and in so doing, reversing decades of policy that direct grants and loans would not be given. It's been a flurry ever since. Since 2019, Australia has given more than $1 billion in loans to Papua New Guinea. Lesser amounts, lesser media coverage, but the Australian government now gives direct support to Timor-Leste, as well as Solomon Islands and Vanuatu. As per the Lowy Institute, Australia has quickly replaced China as the leading source of new bilateral loans to the Pacific. The loans are the most public manifestation of a policy that aims to influence how other countries manage their finances and to avoid them going cap in hand elsewhere looking for cash. Like everything, this work is dressed in the language of partnership and reads like it's been written by a very big committee.
The economic relationship between Papua New Guinea and Australia is one of mutual partnership aimed at fostering growth and the development of our countries, taking into account each other's special economic needs and opportunities. We acknowledge the importance of free and open trade and stable investment regimes for the development and prosperity of our peoples. We commit to exploring new options for trade arrangements between our two countries and a joint feasibility study to inform the process. We will work jointly to address impediments to trade and develop a bilateral trade framework arrangement for better market access. We acknowledge the private sector as key to driving economic cooperation and development, and recognize the role our governments play in facilitating vibrant private sectors. We will continue to engage with the private sector in both countries, including through cooperation with business councils and the Papua New Guinea-Australia Ministerial Forum Business Dialogue.
It's all very mysterious, reminiscent of that line of George Bernard Shaw, that all the languages of all professions are conspiracies against the laity. What does all this lending of money add up to? Does it lead to influence? To find out, I got back in touch with a man who, when we worked together in the autonomous region of Bougainville, had a job description even more incomprehensible than most.
Provide technical advice on the PFM systems, establishing clear linkages between policies and priorities of the ABG to planning, budgeting, financial management, and accounting processes. Support the ABG to articulate their funding needs for specific priority activities and negotiate for funding support with the GoPNG, for example, DNPM, DOT, and DOF, and development partners. Assist to establish effective dialogue regarding policy, political priorities, planning, budgeting, and accounting within and between the administration, the districts, and the BEC.
My name is Peter Haku. I have been working in the area of public financial management and international development assistance for the past 30-odd years. But before that, I came out of a professional background of chartered accounting, which I conducted in both Australia and then, interestingly, in Papua New Guinea as a practicing chartered accountant.
Peter and I used to enjoy dinner and drinks in one of the most far-off outposts of statecraft, the Toyena Hotel in Buka, in the autonomous region of Bougainville. The hotel made its money from government-funded advisors staying there. As an establishment, it had rather memorable decor. There were two ceramic lions near the entrance. There was a giant hole dug in the compound, which was sardonically dubbed the swimming pool. and the rooms cost more than a four-star hotel in Sydney. The most poignant interior feature of the hotel, and a reminder that we were passing through, was a pinboard in the dining room on which were affixed hundreds of business cards of the people who had come before us. People with mysterious titles like Senior Strategic Advisor, Economic Development Counselor, Partnership Coordinator, and the like. The chef did a heroic job cooking hearty meals on a single hot plate, and the wine, aptly, was called Gossips, a few lukewarm glasses of which could ruin any plans for the following day. It was such potent stuff that even a sniff of Gossips could induce a massive hangover. Peter was the perfect person to help disentangle questions about how much influence finance-focused programs have. And to be clear, this time around, our conversation was fortified by nothing stronger than peppermint tea.
I think one of the points that I wanted to make about the whole question of influence is that there is a tremendous affinity for confusing access with influence. And I have found in my experience in a number of programs, in a number of countries, major donors will confuse access and influence. There is a supposition or a presumption that if one has access to a senior ministerial figure or a senior head of a national government department, that all of a sudden one has influence. And I think there is a huge difference, and that difference needs to be teased out in a couple of simple sentences. So access means that they take your call or your meeting. Influence means that you have the ability to impact both policy and policy implementation. There's a vast gulf between these two positions. And I must admit, one of the most intriguing situations for me many, many years ago in Papua New Guinea around public financial management was that the head of the Australian program responsible for accessing and influencing the department was able to get access, but complained bitterly to consultants and others that they lacked influence.
One of my favorite books is that Rudyard Kipling book, The Man Who Would Be King. And it's about these kind of two duffers in the British Empire who go off to far off part in the Northwest frontier, and they get treated like lords. They get treated like gods. And they think this is fantastic. And then everyone turns on them very, very quickly. And they confuse access with influence. And it's a trap that we fall into quite a lot.
It's not easy. I mean, the thing I would say to you is that having worked in 17 different economies now in their public financial management systems quite intimately, one of the things that's intriguing to me is how difficult this is. Because as a donor, time is your enemy. I mean, let's look at some reality in the donor world. The first one is you're going to bring people in who may be 2 years in post, possibly three. You're going to design programs that might have a 3 to 5 year lifespan. In the middle of those terms, you may have changes of government. So one of the really intriguing things about this is we hear about adaptability, we hear about flexibility, we hear about pivot, we hear about all this language, but it's incredibly difficult to do because what you're trying to do is do a political economy analysis of a situation at a point in time. You're then agreeing on a policy impact you'd like to have. You're then trying to design programs that provide the necessary evidence base that gives you a rationale for going to government and saying, here's a policy impact, let's amplify this. And all of that can change as you're doing it. That's item one. Now, item two is that very often you will have key interlocutors. Let's just call these key people. And these people become more important in public financial management, the further down the system you go. So as you go from national to subnational, and this is a point that I want to emphasize, as you go from the ivory tower of national policy, and then you go down to the gutter of practice at the subnational level, you find yourself in a situation where you're really relying on key individuals. And again, we now have personnel changes. You know, somebody goes to a better job, better paid job, whatever, personnel changes combine with political change to effectively blunt. I'm just going to use the word blunt. I don't want to use any other word. Just blunt the purpose of your program. You can have a really well-crafted financial management policy. I mean, let's take the Pacific Islands as an example. It doesn't matter whether you talk Vanuatu, Solomon Islands, Papua New Guinea. You can basically go to any of them. and you will find pretty well crafted, you know, Bougainville is a great example, well crafted financial management legislation, regulation, instructions and guidelines. And then you go to the system and you find that the system is broadly functional. But then when you look at the oversight, it's not there. So especially as you get lower down into the system, as you get down into that low-level system, you need the support of key actors to maintain the environmental controls around the system that make sure that if there is a breach, it's remedied. Now, this is really interesting because take that individual out of the process, or if you never have that individual to start with, all of a sudden you have unremedied breaches. Your policy impact is completely blunted, Gordon. Your influence is lost.
Or to put it another way, individuals are influence. People are policy.
Hugely. And I can't emphasize this enough.
It almost feels like looking for the Holy Grail, this concept of influence, because it gets bogged down very quickly in the tactical and everyday gutter issues that you're talking about. Looking back on your career, what for you is the most crystallizing example of where a public financial management system brought in by a donor or supported by a donor gained quote unquote influence?
Yeah. Very, very, look, a brilliant question, Gordon. It might have been helpful if you'd given me a bit of warning. Can I have a minute just to set context, okay?
Please.
So myself and a female colleague, a dear female colleague of mine, Lee Shaw, we were brought together by the IMF to take a look at a vexatious problem at Solomon Islands. And that was the financial instructions that had been drafted in 1954 under the British rule or British Commonwealth status of Solomon Islands was incomprehensible. And I mean this in the literal sense of the word. The reading standard, the instructions had been written to a reading standard that when Lee grabbed half a dozen paragraphs out of this document and put them into the standardized reading test software that exists, and there are two, by the way, in both sets of software, the reading comprehension standard required to understand these half dozen paragraphs was PhD holder level. Extraordinary. Very, very high. In contrast, the average education level of a Solomon Islands government accounting service employee was grade 10. So we had a set of financial instructions, not only very out of date, but let's just say they were written in a language that was not accessible. So we were asked to do two things. We were asked to bring the regulations up to date, given the many, many changes that had occurred through not only the effluxion of time, but also the involvement of the Australian Aid Program in introducing what we would call global good practice into the financial management of government. And then to reduce the complexity of the language to the point where it became accessible to somebody in grade 10. So we had a very specific quality assurance test on this document. Lee was going to be required to run it through these two reading test programs to see what the comprehension level was. Now, I think that piece of work was probably one of the most effective things that we did because we took out things that were simply no longer relevant. There was discussion in there about interagency invoicing, for example, that just didn't exist anymore, et cetera. I won't go into any further detail because people's eyes will glaze over. But the intriguing thing was that we drafted this, we put it on the table, and then if you want proof of the fact that it was a useful piece of work, the IMF's involvement was completely ignored as the major donor in the Solomon Islands rushed to seize ownership of this and say that they'd done it, which they duly did. All of this would have happened in about 2007, say, Gordon. I had the opportunity to go back in 2016, some 9 years later, to find that this document was still in use. And what was very interesting was that the Australian support from Australian deployees, so let's be very clear, these are not consultants necessarily employed by managing contractors. These are mid to senior level officials deployed out of the Australian government, national departments and state departments. They were also still able to reference this document and use it. So I think it even had some longevity.
I wanted to ask Peter about those loans that we began the show with. Where did the money go? How was it used? Was it ever paid back?
Can you talk us through the process by which that happens? And secondly, does that buy influence? And maybe a third point, is this cordoned off? Like, is there a separate bank account in the Treasury in Papua New Guinea that is called the Australian bank account? Or does it all just sort of the equivalent of me throwing in a bottle of water into the ocean and then it all gets diluted?
Okay, the budget support payments, which we'll just call big grants, just for the sake of easy language, they tend to go in large lumps. They tend to be built around specific agreements. So they'll usually have their own MOU, Memorandum of Understanding. And those payments will go, for example, to the National Treasury. And there will be some conditionality around that, that that is intended to be used by the Ministry of Health, the Ministry of Education, the Ministry of Infrastructure, etc. There are a couple of factors around these in terms of influence. I want to go to the influence question now. The first one is scale. If you give a really big volume of budget support, this now has a significant part of the national budget, the state budget. And were anything to go wrong around that, the state budget would be quite severely impacted. And this is referred to as aid dependency, donor dependency, largely conceived of as a negative thing in some circles, but a necessary thing in some economies. And we can give examples like the Solomon Islands, where the aid program has been a significant proportion. Conversely, the aid program is not a significant proportion any longer of the Papua New Guinea budget. So, you know, scale is an issue. Now, is scale enough? Does this buy you influence? Well, I think there's a real question here, because it's not just buying influence, it's what can undo influence. So I think one of the intriguing things is that where a donor presses too hard on the policy and policy impact side, I think the personal nature of that engagement can undo the positive impact of a large lump of money hitting the national account. So I think there's a very complex intersection here between the personal relationships that you have with government and how you manage what you see as things going awry. Because I think the personal relationship can undo the influence that you're buying through these large budget support contributions. The Papua New Guinea example. Australia was giving significant budget support contributions in the sort of 2006-2007 era. At the same time, Australia also had a significant level of technical assistance in and around the head of the finance department's office. Those relationships became strained, and I think that offset much of the influence that Australia was able to garner through the budget support, because it now became a contentious personal relationship. The cause of the contention was the treatment by government of Papua New Guinea of what was really an embarrassment of riches. Papua New Guinea started exporting oil and gas. All of a sudden, we had these very large increases in the money in the treasury. Supplementary budgets were being formed, and the nature of those supplementary budgets, the allocations being made to various sectors were not agreed with by the advisors. And I think this created some tension. And as a consequence of that, I think both access and influence was impacted. You know, this is where I'm saying the scale of intervention alone isn't going to carry the day, but I think you have a greater chance. There is a greater opportunity for buying influence where you have scale. If we then go to the smaller granting mechanism, you can have a great deal of influence, but then it has to be married with this personal engagement. So you can have pretty small granting systems. And, you know, I think there are some good examples of this in the area of civil society engagement, where relatively small grants that come through the aid system that impact civil society very positively, good working relationships between the program and the individuals receiving the grants, reasonably high degree of mutual accountability towards one another. I think things go very, very well. There is also, of course, examples of grant schemes that have gone quite badly awry. And one of the reasons for that is that those relationships don't work, or the structure hasn't been well designed. And the one that comes to mind there for me was the HIV/AIDS program in Papua New Guinea. which for a period of time was supported by significant, you know, a couple of million Australian dollars a year to individual large national NGOs that were then leading or a significant part of the national HIV/AIDS response. And I think what was very interesting here was that the program had not actually done its due diligence to the extent that might have been helpful. And so a number of problems emerged around this granting program, which put a great deal of pressure back on the Australian aid program to up its level of monitoring and oversight. And this is where, Gordon, we come to your point about, you know, a very high degree of scrutiny, because these programs don't tend to be Australian Treasury writing a check to PNG Treasury. These programs tend to be entrusted to individuals within the Australian aid program who are then effectively placing their confidence and trust in their counterpart. And so the failure of or the shortcomings in the granting environment tend to be personalized. And I think this is where the scrutiny, the high level of scrutiny and oversight comes in, because it is attached to individual professional and career risk. Interestingly to note, on the other side of that formula, there's very little individual personal or career risk within the national NGO associated with perhaps not being as transparent or accountable as they should have been with these resources, because the oversight mechanism just isn't there.
Yeah, I mean, I think those are really compelling examples. They get into this really interesting kind of chapeau that comes in, which is you've got the individuals where failure tends to be personalized, or the relationship tends to be personalized. And look, even at our relationship, we have a good relationship, which means I'm able to ring you up and say, I'd like to get you on a podcast. You say, great. If you didn't want to be, you would come up with 1,000 reasons why you couldn't. But yet there's the chapeau that accompanies a lot of Australia's relationships in Papua New Guinea, or any donor's relationship in any other country, is that of the relationship. And the relationship is always being taken to the next level. Bonds are always being strengthened. And it creates, I think, a real difficulty for the street level bureaucrats that are working on these programs, because they cannot go against the prevailing message.
I think there's also this question of going back to the oversight and the scrutiny and all the rest of it. There are individual events that transmit a shockwave through these systems, which then trigger a whole series of internal sensitivity within the donor organization around granting and grants and oversight of grants, management of grants, you know, and it does get down to a very, very fine level.
That's the insider's take. What did everyday Papua New Guineans, who we sent Godfrey out to meet, make of all this support? Their answer was a bit like me looking at my own bank statements. Few credits, mostly debits, and underlying concerns about financial management.
Aid donors, whoever they might be, Australia's our biggest, are giving Papua New Guinea huge amounts of Australian taxpayers' dollars every year. And we go and do silly things like buy 40 Maseratis for APEC, which were never used. Doesn't that feel like a slap in the face? And wherever that money came from, I don't know whether it came straight from aid donors or it was our own money that we've made from our own natural resources or our gas or whatever it is. It's sort of like if you give your child lunch money and they just go and spend it on completely unnecessary things and they don't eat lunch. And Papua New Guineans are not eating lunch. You know what I mean? Where are the kids going to school and not eating lunch? We're going and buying cigarettes or alcohol and doing things that our parents are not, you know, giving us the money for, basically. But I wouldn't like to say that Australia is a parent giving us, you know, lunch money, but I feel like it's just a slap in the face. And wouldn't anyone go, wow, if you're going to be mismanaging this money that we're giving you, why should we keep giving you so much money, you know? And yes, we are a sovereign nation and no one's going to tell us how to spend the money. However, is there any sort of way that we should be showing people, or these people that are giving us so much money and helping us, bailing us out pretty much all the time? Shouldn't we be a bit more responsible?
The thing about aid, in my opinion, however, is I feel that most of the big donors that give aid to a country, you know, give it the conditions tied. So I do believe that they spend it well and they report back on how it's been spent. So I think it's accounted for, which is really good. So I do think that aid money is spent well. However, if you read the newspaper a couple of days ago about the lack of auditing because the government doesn't actually have money in the budget to give for audits to be carried out by the Auditor General's office, just goes to show that I wouldn't be able to be in a position to say that the money is spent as effectively as it should, because we don't even have reports to show that, yes, the money has been spent. These projects that have been ongoing, the money has been spent well and it's been spent on what it needs to be spent on. As for aid money, I do think that it is spent adequately because being tied to particular conditions and the reporting back on those monies are actually adhered to the reporting requirements.
I think our governments have had good intentions, and it's evident in the budgets that they pass annually, and it also shows where, you know, the focus is, the priority areas is. The priority areas are in areas that we need as a nation, in sectors like health, law and order, agriculture. They have their priorities right, and they're putting money in those areas. The only thing is the reporting of this spending and the accountability that comes with it. Reporting is very important in us determining where the money is being spent and how it can be better spent on priority areas.
Well, Minister, thanks very much for joining the ABC. Now, you've announced today, effectively, that Australia's going to loan an additional $100 million US to PNG to help it in a pretty difficult financial time. Can you explain why you're doing that?
The Australian government has decided to extend our support to PNG following a direct request from the PNG government. The economic conditions have come to a point where budget support is needed. They've made a request to us, and given COVID, we've seen fit to extend that support to make sure that they have the finance they need to keep stability in their operation of their government and make sure that they can pay their bills during a very difficult economic time.
That's former Minister for the Pacific, Alex Hawke, in 2020, announcing another loan to Papua New Guinea. Since Mateus Cormann's initial announcement that began this podcast, Australia has now given over $1 billion worth of loans to Papua New Guinea, as per details on the Department for Foreign Affairs and Trade's website. Influence anticipated and influence received is not mentioned explicitly in any of the messaging, and influence is such a slippery currency, it's hard to know what has been acquired as a result. It's also hard to find any details as to whether any of these loans have been paid back. Type the words Papua New Guinea into the search engine of Export Finance Australia, which managed the loan, and no results are found. I was thoroughly confused, and I rang an expert for help.
Yeah, so my name is Maholopa, surname Lavelle. You can call me Maho. I teach at the University of PNG in economics undergraduate, and I'm doing a one-year fellowship at the Lowe Institute. So I'm a Pacific fellow at the Lowe Institute.
Maho was definitely the person to speak to, but even for an astute budget reader like him, he didn't have the precise answer.
So for the 2019 loan, it's very difficult to actually sift through PNG budget documents and see where the sectors are that the loan was spent in. But we know from what the PNG government does with loans is that it funds its capital budget. So not its operational budget, but its capital development budget. And a lot of the loans go to high impact infrastructure projects. And most of it goes to transport, utilities, and the health sector. And that loan was about $300 million, so that translated to about $1 billion kina. So that was pretty sizable in that it lifted PNG government's expenditure, and also it was a sizable part of the fiscal deficit that it ran that year.
So that's a bit like me pouring a bottle of water into the ocean. I mean, once it enters the accounts, it's very hard to know where the money actually went.
Yes, and the other problem with that is that once the loans go in, the PNG government can then pull money out of those sectors which, say, the Australian government wants to fund in, and then put it in other sectors. So in that sense, it's sort of the money that goes in from the Australian government is fungible.
So this was a 12-month loan. So given in November 2019, theoretically it should have been paid back in November 2020. Was the money paid back?
So it was funded by the Export Finance Facility, and it was a concessional loan by PNG government standards, but by the Australian government standards, it was semi-commercial loan, and there was about 2% interest. So what's happened since is that the Australian government has refinanced the loan and has given it a 15-year repayment period, And so if that was given in 2019, it'd be paid back after 2030. And it's given it at about a 1% interest rate. So that means that it's very low, very gracious repayment periods. And also the loan interest rate, it was paused, I'd say, when the G20 summit for the pandemic occurred. But then again, it's continued since then.
Next question, Maho. These loans are tied to something called an IMF staff monitored program. What is a staff monitored program? Is it the IMF monitoring Papua New Guinean staff? Is it IMF staff monitoring something? I mean, what are the elements of a staff monitored program? And I guess maybe another question is, why does Australia get the IMF to do this monitoring work? Given that it's given the money, why doesn't it just do the work itself?
So my belief is that I think the IMF has better expertise in monitoring. So the Bank of PNG, the PNG Treasury and Finance, and so it's easier that way. And I think what the staff monitor program does is it's staff monitoring different fiscal arrangements and also having a certain set of criteria so the PNG government has to meet, basically. So I think the Treasurer described it as a certificate of economic governance. And so with the staff monitored program, really lets external donors know that the government's actually progressing in the right direction fiscally.
So last year, the IMF staff monitor program ended and there was a report produced. I mean, what did that tell us? What did it tell us about how Papua New Guinea is progressing in terms of, what was that phrase you used, this certificate of economic governance?
Yeah, it said that the Treasury PG government had actually met a lot of the reforms that were tied to it, or at least some of the criteria. So the Treasurer has listed 31 criteria to be met. Seven of that was budget performance, so actually improving revenue. So, for example, the Internal Revenue Commission beefing up its capability, revisiting the corporate income tax, passing new legislation, or at least amending existing legislation, reducing fiscal deficits, repaying arrears, reducing the civil servant wage bill, and actually having a plan to fiscal balance in 2027. So that was largely met. I mean, actually also sort of improving capabilities within all those different departments was largely met, or at least progressing still. One thing that wasn't met was the sovereign wealth fund. So one of that was actually getting the sovereign wealth fund operational and actually depositing resource revenues and dividends from resource projects into it. And that hasn't happened. But on the whole, it's met most of the reforms tied to it.
So we're interested in this podcast in seeing whether actions like giving loans or funding police reform programs or funding defense reform programs actually bring influence. Because really, we're not giving a $300 million loan and allowing it to be restructured for 15 years just out of a sense of sheer altruism. There's a kind of geopolitics, geoeconomics at stake here. Now, influence is, I know, especially for you as an economist, it's the most rubbery and imperfectly imprecise phrase. Like, what does influence mean? But noting that, can you point to what influence this loan had and what subsequent loans have had in terms of Australia's influence in Papua New Guinea?
So it's really good to frame this in the context of James Marape, who's the PNG Prime Minister, his predecessor. So Peter O'Neill served at least as the PNG Prime Minister from about 2011 to 2019. And largely, he ran a lot of fiscal deficits. He borrowed a lot domestically and his loans were commercial. So there are no reforms, at least tied to commercial loans. He ran up the debt levels to a point where when the pandemic came in, basically the PNG government was fiscally constrained, couldn't borrow commercially, and so switched to concession loans. Now, when you switch to concession loans, you have no choice. And so there was a lot of external pressure to bear on bringing a lot of reforms that otherwise would not have been implemented. So I've listed a lot of the fiscal reforms. There were other governance reforms that are of note. So in 2020, under Marape, there was a Whistleblowers Act that would protect really government employees blowing the whistle on government policy, right? There was passing legislation for the Independent Commission Against Corruption, which is yet to be operational, but that was significant. And again, the Bank of PNG review was pretty good. Also, the state-owned entities, which has come after the staff monitored program, which is basically focusing on privatizing state-owned entities, but focusing on them phase by phase. So the first one is PNG Power, which is the largest and a monopoly in electricity provision. And basically, I think the plan is to split them in different phases and sell off the electricity generation and the wholesale, or at least the power grids. So that would make it more streamlined, more effective, remove political interference and make it more profitable in the long run. And then focus on the other utilities like water, the postal service, other wharf service as well. So the state-owned entities is very important because it's a large source of government revenue. It has a history of political interference and corruption. And it has debt of about 15 billion kina, which is important because that 15 billion kina is not included in official debt estimates by Treasury. And Treasury right now is at about 40 billion kina in total debt. So we know that the PNG government guarantees half of that. And if all those state-owned entities which aren't profitable default on those loans, it just adds more pressure on government. So reforming them is good. It's a very important step. And the fact that ADB has stepped in really points to the fact that, again, government's progressing in the right direction fiscally. And again, it can give more confidence to external donors that you can still provide budget support and that it's used for good purposes, I'd say.
I'm really grateful for Maho for helping me step through these issues so clearly. His focus was on the macro picture, and it was a good complement to Peter's focus on the micro. Peter reminded us that once again, when it comes to effective statecraft, a state is only as good as the people it sends. Individuals are influence. People are policy in this part of statecraft as well. Send someone with emotional intelligence, and one is likely to get a return on investment. Send someone with less emotional intelligence and the balance sheet is going to look completely different. And this loan repayment that I was talking to Maho about, going from 1 year to 15 years, also shows that even ostensibly indebted governments have big influence in the game of statecraft. Whatever Papua New Guinea planned or needed to do to be able to repay the loan 12 months later clearly didn't happen. And Australia either didn't have the influence or leverage or desire to make it happen. But Papua New Guinea did have the influence to refinance the loan with Australia, begging the question of which of these two states has the most influence over the other. Next week, we'll delve into the sector that constitutes among the biggest slices of statecraft in budgetary terms, governance and public administration programs. And we'll ask, what influence do these programs buy? I'm your host, Gordon Peake. Mark Peter Nataras and Shanna Ryan at Cultural Pulse produce the podcast. Joanne Wallace at University of Adelaide is the executive producer. Luther Knut is the sound engineer and producer. This activity was supported by the Australian government through a grant by the Australian Department of Defence to the University of Adelaide. The views expressed are those of the authors and are not necessarily those of the Australian government, the Australian Department of Defence, or the University of Adelaide.